Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this fine evening?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm just reminded of a little jingle of it's going to turn up. It's going to get wild. So hold your horses. You might get Lyled.
It's going to turn out. It's going to get wild. So hold your horses.
I don't know about you, but I've had that jingle stuck in my head the last week.
Okay, fair enough. All right, let's see what we got.
All right, so we got a couple of questions today on the evolution of language, something called emotional first aid, and a couple of situations from our listeners for helping their friends. But before we get to that, there's one question that I got just a couple of days ago that just struck my fancy because I could relate to it a lot. So we'll just take it from there. So, dear Dr. Lyle, is there something sexy about being a doomsdayer? This podcast and Matt Ridley have given me a more optimistic view of the future, but now I consistently notice men around smart, beautiful women one-upping each other on how bleak the present and the future look. What traits are they advertising?
Oh, this is beautiful. Yeah. So that's a great question. It's clear that what they're advertising is conscientiousness and intelligence. So they're basically saying, I'm a lot smarter than other people that can't see into the future and can't analyze all these horrendous contingencies, that I'm able to put together the evidence in a complex way and see trouble where the world is not seeing it. And I'm so worried about it because I'm so worried about other people. And so therefore, this is the kind of mind that you need to father your children. Somebody that's really going to look out, you know, and see things that other people can't see. It's hilarious. I mean, you see this with global warming, public health crises, environmental crisis, economic crisis, you know, children and TV, like everybody's, you know, one-upping each other into the horrendous crises that the world is facing. And Harry Brown, who's probably my very favorite sort of psychological, philosophical writer, has a name for this, and he calls it the burning issue trap. And the notion is that, you know, there's these burning issues out there, and we can't all rest and be happy until these burning issues are addressed, and the world is not going to be free until this happens. You know, a lot, I have good friends of mine who feel these things, who feel a desperate desire to point out to the world the world's ills and the terrible things that are going to happen, and they aren't doing what can I say? They're not the grandstanding that's going on behind this can be very honest, and part of it can be coming from legitimate conscientiousness. Some of it is sexual grandstanding, which they would never admit and would not possibly even have any access psychologically to know that that is what's driving it. But the truth is, folks, is all these types of problems are essentially moderate in nature. So I can remember hearing, I believe it was Dean Ornish, you know, saying in hushed tones that, you know, this generation will be the first generation that doesn't outlive its parents. Now, I'm trying to, this is, I actually can't remember the exact quote or what was exactly what was said, but the possible inference was that kids might be so sick they'd die before their parents would die, which is, of course, not what was being said, but it starts to sound like, and it starts to getting people alarmed. The second way to interpret this is that children will not, this will be the first, quote, generation that will not live as long as its parents. Well, second of all, there's no evidence for this. Zero. The issues with public health, for example, they're notable. You know, people are overweight and sick and struggling and medicated and, you know, not very healthy. But the truth is they live a long time, and they're living longer, considerably longer than they ever lived before. So this generation now that is now 50 will outlive the people that were their parents on average, and they'll do so by a significant margin, by probably a couple of years. And we're starting to get so that people are essentially so safe with such a benign environment that they're living pretty close to the edge of their genetic code. If you're a non-smoker, you're getting pretty close to every mile that you can get out of this car. You're leaving it a little short. But the big issue with public health really is not longevity and crisis and people dying. It's really function. And these issues are a question of personal choice. You can't tell me that people don't know that they shouldn't be putting the pizza and chocolate shakes down, and that they shouldn't be walking around the block and eating an apple. Of course they know this. They may think the chicken and fish are a good thing, and they may not be such a good thing. But people are making personal choices on these things, and they're running their own cost-benefit analysis. Now, the same kind of panic that we hear about children and television and now children and cell phones and how the next generation is going to be so, you know, incompetent or stupid or ADHD, et cetera, et cetera. This is all much ado about totally nothing. Global warming, I just got to roll my eyes. It's like all you got to do is look at the evidence and see that we are within 1 degree of where we were 100 years ago. So whatever terrible problems await us, not that terrible. And
here I am
not
complaining
that
about the cold every week.
What's that?
So then here I am complaining about the cold every week, you know. So.
Yeah, so the issue is, I'm not saying that there's nothing to these issues. There are things to these issues. These problems are legitimate concerns for people to sort of put in the big matrix of a big picture. But if you put things in a big matrix of a big picture, folks, the correct vision of your life and your location in history is the same picture that Matt Ridley and Steven Pinker have, which is that there has never been a better time to be alive. It's not even close. And you live, if you are in a Western democracy, you live in the safest, freest, best fed, longest lived, most opportunity time in world history. There is less prejudice against divorce, race, religion, gender, everything. Okay, so you live in the best time that there has ever been, and you will live out your life in the best time that has ever been. So for God's sakes, don't spend a bunch of time and energy worried about these burning issues that are not going to burn anything. So just relax and enjoy yourself. But yes, this is a beautiful place for people to grandstand, particularly men that will get on the balcony and grandstand to attractive women about how brilliant and insightful and how essentially undervalued their great brilliance is, because they should be given awards and Nobel Prizes and accolades for being the great sage that is predicting doomsday. If you want a wonderful history of this, Matt Ridley in The Rational Optimist spends several pages talking through the last 175 years. That started in about 1825. He tracks the doomsday commentary of generation after generation after generation and just blows it to smithereens, showing that essentially it's almost never been true. The certainly there have been times when life got grim and bad. Hitler was bad news. The atomic age was scary and remains scary. However, many of these things are well beyond anybody's ability to influence any outcomes at all. So pay attention to your own life and make the best of your own existence, and don't worry about where the world is going, because it's kind of going wherever it's going anyway, and it's going fine. All right.
Let's move on. Well, this makes me think is for this particular listener, and I guess for other men listening too. If we start to display this rational optimism, will we be more likely to attract less conscientious mates who do not overestimate the worst case scenario or simply aren't concerned about it?
Let's think about that. I don't know. I don't know what value there would be. I think that I can imagine. I think I've got this right. I think it's what this is it's saying, my intelligence is seeing contingencies and threats that other people are not seeing. Now, if you go against that, as I do, and I say, well, that's just ludicrous. There's no, you've got no chain of evidence here at all. There's no advantage really that is obvious to the female worrying about her children, her unborn children, or her life itself. There's really no particular advantage to underestimating the worst case scenario that she's going to easily see. So I don't really see that this is advantageous. So we'll just find out next time I'm at a party, which I never go to, and there's an attractive woman there who wouldn't be talking to me anyway. We'll just see if I drum up a worst case scenario to see if I could get at least 60 seconds of FaceTime. We'll find out.
Yeah, because I frequently think that perhaps when men are interested in a pair bond strategy, I'm not sure if that's true, but if men are interested in a pair bond strategy, they'll try to display conscientiousness and intelligence.
Yeah.
Whereas if they're in a casual strategy, they're trying to display openness and passion. But
and also
who knows?
Possibly the confidence that would come with being able to handle whatever obstacles would come. So. So, i.e., the openness and the ability to have survived that openness. So, also the disagreeable and dominance to actually contradict this other sort of zeitgeist of the world of panic and cowering. So the there would be a way for the Matt Ridley Steven Pinker take on life to be a little bit sexy, but. So far, no traction for me. So I think the doomsdayers definitely have us beat on this strategy. All right, let's go on to the next thing.
All right, our next question. Dr. Lyle, I'm a speech pathology graduate student, and I got into the field because I had a great interest in how we develop language so naturally. What was the evolutionary drive for language development in early humans? I'm also curious about your opinion on language instruction and intervention for children who are showing deficits in expressive or receptive language. If language is something that's hardwired into us, why do some of us show language deficits even though intelligence and comprehension are normal?
Yes. I can't expertly answer this question, so don't think I'm not going to answer it. But I can't expertly answer it because I actually don't know the data. I'm going to give you my impressions of this, and and then hope the person who answered this doesn't slit their wrists. Okay, here we go. I want you to imagine, have you ever run into anybody that couldn't talk? Now, I have not. I have never run into a person that could not talk. And I've actually been in a room and talking to people. Actually, you know what? It's just occurring to me that that's not true. I actually have spent a little while, an afternoon, in a place with children that have extraordinary disabilities, that they're actually in an inpatient facility for life. I remember this was in Denton in North Texas, and this was a state school called Denton State School. I went there and was talking to the guy that was the head of psychology there, a guy by the name of Ira Cullerin, and I chit-chatted with him and looked at some of his patients, and they were kids that basically were on the order of IQs in the order of 50. In other words, very far below the level of the cutoff for mental retardation. And so these are people with whose brains have horrendous dysfunction. And these kids could not talk. So there are people that you will see in this life that cannot talk, but they will never talk. The question is, do you ever run into anybody walking around that can't hardly hold down a job because they're not smart enough to push a broom? But they can manage to do this, and can they talk? And the answer is yes, they can talk. And they can walk. So the truth of the matter is that I have also had a number of clients over the years that had children or grandchildren where there was great consternation over whether or not these kids were going to talk because it was 2 years and they weren't talking. And I just roll my eyeballs, and they would be having speech pathologists and et cetera, and meetings with the speech pathologist, and I just consider this to be a total joke. Because guess what? I've never met anybody that couldn't talk. So kids will learn how to talk. And the truth is that they can hack this up into, well, can they produce speech, or are they receiving speech? Can they know what they're doing, et cetera? The truth is that I am unaware of any evidence to indicate that any speech pathological process is going to be helpful. The notion is, oh my God, there might be windows of development. If we don't get on it, do everything we can, they may not, we may leave them behind. But I want you to back up and ask yourself, have you ever met anybody that ever got left behind? I haven't. I've met, 25,000 people in my life. I've never met one of them that when I was talking to them, they couldn't talk. So let's look at what I believe is happening in the world of speech pathology, that you have a lot of people that are worried sick about their children. And the common fear is that your kid has some pathology of some kind, and they're not going to figure it out, that they're not going to figure out how to talk. And as a result of this, they're going to be severely handicapped in life and be in trouble. And so, therefore, this is a perfect example of where the worst-case scenario should be ringing everybody's chimes at 150 decibels, which it would be if it was me. If I had some kid that wasn't talking and wasn't talking and wasn't talking and wasn't talking, and I'm like staring at this little thing thinking, whoa, this is a disaster. Okay, and if I didn't know what I know, I would be very worried and be like, well, better safe than sorry. Let's go to the speech pathologist and start doing some drills. Okay? I think it's a total waste of time. And if somebody's got evidence that I'm wrong, send it to me. But the truth of the matter is, like I said, never met anybody that couldn't talk. The issue here is how strong the drive is. I have never met anybody that couldn't learn to walk either. Okay? There's people with neurological diseases that can't do it, but any normally functioning human that has a normal body learns how to walk. Nobody doesn't learn how to walk. Nobody doesn't learn how to talk. The development of language, we're not sure when it took place, certainly. A lot of speculation about that. Probably, it certainly We know for certain it's been around at a very, very high level for at least 150,000 years because it's ubiquitous all over the earth for breeding populations that are, you know, 100,000 years apart. There's people on the earth that haven't had a common ancestor for 100,000 years. So we know that this goes back that far, and it goes back that far at the level of the sophistication that you see in all races. So that tells you that all human beings were already at extraordinarily sophisticated language by 100 or so thousand years ago. And if they were at that level of sophistication, i.e. 60,000 words at their disposal for the average speaker, then you know damn well that it was at least 30,000 per speaker, you know, 100,000 years before that, and 10,000 per speaker 100,000 years before that, and 5,000, 100,000 years before that. So this language capability has probably been around at a pretty significant level for several 100,000 years. The question, now I've got a friend of mine, a paleontologist, that tells me that the evidence would suggest that language abilities would have been so incredibly valuable as they started to develop that it would have exploded, that the additional brains necessary to support language would have been so heavily advantaged by evolution that it would have quickly spread like wildfire and been highly advantageous. That's another part of this person's question, like why would this develop? Well, the reason is that the cost-benefit analysis on the transmission and reception of information. So I want you to think about the capability that is conferred to an organism that could spend years learning a skill and then transmit that skill to somebody else in a matter of minutes. The ability to transmit information about the environment and say, hey, listen, let me explain. Over there on the other side of the hill, I was just over there. Let me tell you what I saw. Okay, so this the transmission of information and the inexpensiveness of the transmission of that information that is possible through language is truly a light year leap ahead of anything else other animals can do. And so it conferred enormous benefits in order to be able to both produce that language, particularly, as you can imagine, to transmit it important information to your children and to anybody that's useful to you. That's why language took off like wildfire. That's how I see this. Absolutely hardwired. Requires some tuning that goes on in early childhood as the kids learn through a learning curve process. Sort of the sounds and they put this stuff together. It's really quite interesting. What goes on in terms of human early language development. It's literally a hybrid between genetically constrained systems and then the ability to fine-tune those with local sounds, i.e. the learning of a specific language and its sounds. But essentially, that's what it is, and it's so advantageous. The drive for it is akin to the drive for walking. So speech pathology and its utility, I think it's probably more useful. There may be drills to help people after they've had strokes and head injuries, et cetera. But speech pathology in early childhood, I would be very surprised if there's evidence, if there's significant percentages of people that they have shown that literally if they're not intervened on, they do not develop normal capabilities. So could be wrong, open to contradiction. This person, I would say, if you're a speech pathology grad student, I would look very carefully at what areas of speech pathology are actually known to have positive effects, and I'd spend my career there, and I think it would be a great career, as many things would be if the effects are really there. And the sub-niches within the field, that's where I would go.
Fantastic.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good.
All right, dear.
Well, let me see. Wait, they said hardwired. Why are some of us showing language deficits, even though intelligence and comprehension are normal? Well, certain neural circuits in different individuals come online at different times. So that's why kids walk at different levels at times, and kids talk at different levels and times, and et cetera, et cetera. So the genes are not all identical here. There is rival genes that build noses and ears and hearts and lungs and red twitch, fast twitch fibers in the muscles, build them all a little bit differently. And so therefore, when you have to look at these milestones and where your kid is on the chart, you know, everybody's so freaking panicked about where their kid is on the chart. And they're worried, oh, my God, my kid's only, 1 foot, 10 inches tall, and they're almost 3 years old or 2 years old, so they're not on the chart. Everybody's worried about the freaking chart. Relax. These are little plants. You water them and you feed them and they emerge, okay? We're not going to shape them. Just take care of them, love them, let them play, and chill out. All right. Move on.
All right. Speaking of letting them play and chilling out.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle, what is the best emotional first aid? So, for example, if I run into a kid that escaped a traumatic event like a shooting, a rape survivor, or somebody who just got a beating, how does one assist in such situations?
Well, let's think about this. Let's go back to the Stone Age if something like this happens. Let's think about what people would have done in the Stone Age. They'd say, holy smokes, you doing okay? And what's going on? Are you worried about something? Let's make sure that you feel safe in the situation that you're in, okay? So where are you sleeping? Who are you sleeping? Who can you talk to? You get nervous, et cetera. The notion that there's some damage done by the trauma and we got to try to do something spectacular and empathic in order to make sure that that doesn't take place is ludicrous. The human beings are designed by nature to have processing processes in place for when they run into traumatic, dangerous things. And the way this is designed is that the memory circuits are flagging these incidents, and they are computing correlation coefficients with respect to the environmental context in which these things took place. The kid doesn't have any fallout from this particularly, insofar as obviously if you just almost got run over by a car yesterday, then I'm going to expect that you're going to be considerably more nervous about that today. And you're going to be considerably nervous about that the day after tomorrow and the day after that for a while. And then it's going to turn out that in your long-term history, even a year from now, you're going to be significantly, though not in any bizarre way, more nervous about this than your friend who hasn't had that happen to them for good reason. So you have become aware of a worst-case scenario, and its probability is now heightened in your mind because you've actually had that incident happen to you. The same thing is going to happen if a kid witnessed some nasty thing or they've been a victim of something, et cetera. What's going to happen is it's going to influence their perceived probability of having that kind of a loss or trauma happen again. And they're going to engage in mitigating activities that will reduce the statistical likelihood of those things happening. So they'll avoid the bully, they'll avoid Uncle Louie, they'll avoid all kinds of things, just as they should. And our job, once we find out about it, is to say, hey, how can we help you get safe? Let's think this through. Let's see what I can do to see to it that you are now buffered against this, okay? If you ever get nervous about this, that, or the other, you come to me, or here's where you're going to go, and here's who you're going to talk to make sure you get some assistance so that you don't have to face this kind of threat again. That's what we do, okay? So it turns out that the research evidence indicates that when my colleagues go into schools that have had terrible things happen and they sit down and they want to process endlessly and have kids talk about these things and et cetera, that it does more harm than good. That it's going to turn out that the kind of hand-holding and hand-wringing and, quote, deep sympathy process that goes on in PTSD after post-trauma work turns out to be worse than useless, interestingly enough. So let's it's actually surprising that you could be worse than useless, but it apparently is the case. So what we want to do is instead do what you would reasonably do. A person has had a threat or a person's had a traumatic event. What do we want to do? We want to have them, you know, feel not an absurd cloak of safety, but a cloak of safety and a problem solving and a natural empathy that would make sense. We don't need to catastrophize over this. I actually think that the problem comes when clinicians catastrophize because the clinician themselves has a couple of agendas. You can start to see this, that the clinician might themselves, with a psychodynamic or a misunderstanding of neural architecture, might believe that this is actually a terrible thing, horrendous thing, and oh my God, horrible scars have been laid down now and the person will never be the same. Well, at that point, the uneducated, naive clinician is panicking, and they're going to resonate that panic to the victim. It's also which you know essentially can have the victim thinking about, oh my God, I'm in deeper shit than I thought I was in. Okay, it's kind of like a doctor ominously staring at you and looking at your lab report, saying, "Whoa, this is terrible." It's like, well, what is it? Whoa, it's terrible. Oh, my God, this is terrible. It's like, for crying out loud, you're going to suffer. Okay, so this is that's one thing. Another thing is that many people in this arena are going to essentially be acting on status motivation, that now this is something terrible that's happened and it's very important work needs to be done now. Very important work needs to be done. It's like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't need to be done. What you need to be is practical and reasonable and reasonably empathic and supportive. That's how you want to handle it, okay? And so, therefore, the individual doesn't have to put up with the fact that the person on the other side is staring at the lab report of their future with horror in their face and in their voice. There is no horror in our – it's like, hey – if something bad happened to you, something bad happened to you. If there's some perpetrator that's responsible, then we're pissed off, okay? And what we need to do is we need to think through how it is that we're going to protect them because they have that right to be protected, and this is a terrible thing that happened. And we're going to step through all possible channels and be intelligent about how we're going to do that. And you know what? You're going to have some feelings that are going to be no fun. So let's make sure that you know what you're going to do if those feelings get more intense, okay? But we can have a non-catastrophic attitude about this that is the best way to handle this, okay?
Wow.
All right.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right, so we're going to turn the ship a little bit, and we're going to go over a couple of listener situations.
Okay.
All right, dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a 25-year-old female, and I'm very worried about my sister and her future. She's my half-sister, and she's 30, and she's engaged to a man who's 32, turns out to be a liar, and in my opinion, a huge scumbag. They started dating about 2 years ago, and he seemed like a nice guy, fairly charismatic. He told us he was a lawyer, had gone to school overseas, and then it came to light a year into their relationship that this was all a lie. Apparently, all of his friends knew, and he only lied to my sister and my family. He then revised his story to say that he was working for an education and training program and studying law. This also turned out to be a lie. During this time, he lived in my parents' house for 2 months for free while he supposedly was on injury leave, but he carried around a briefcase the whole time. Well, he and my sister have now been living at my sister's mom's house for a year without rent. My sister recently tried to convince her mother to cover his car payment, which she refused. My sister doesn't live at home, and we rarely spend time with them, so it was only when introducing him as their daughter's fiancé at a holiday party and being questioned by their friends about his career that my parents had a wake-up call and decided to investigate into him. Turns out he's in debt, only partway through a bachelor's degree, and his previous co-workers have severed ties with him because he owes one of them $3,000 as determined in a small claims court.
So his previous church has severed ties with him, and he appears to be unemployed. And according to my parents, he's also been pressuring my sister to become pregnant soon. So my parents confronted her, tried to be caring, telling her that it ultimately was her decision, but they wanted her to be informed. Well, she's since taken her fiancé's side and says that my parents betrayed him by investigating him and aren't treating him with love and support as they should a family member. As you can imagine, this is horrible tension in the family because of this. And to make matters worse, my parents have asked my brother and I to pretend that we don't know anything about the confrontation or the information. I can't understand how my sister, an attractive, intelligent, and overly agreeable person, continues to defend this clearly dishonest person. Is there any chance to convince her to leave him? What a mess. Wow.
Oh, my. What a thing to watch. Let's see. Let me think about this. Let me try to think about how I would handle this, something like this. If I were in the situation, I would probably come up with a label for this guy that would, I would probably want to stick it under my sister's fingernails and really have it bother her. And I'm not sure what the parents were not wanting to her them to say, or I can't remember what that situation was, but I would definitely, I would feel absolutely a moral responsibility to my sister to do the very best job I could of convincing her that she was making a big mistake. And I let me tell you what I mean, obviously, this guy is a sociopath. That's what he is. And so this is a that's just what he is. Just look it up in the DSM, and it's got this guy's face all over it. Now, he's not a dangerous sociopath in the sense that he's not slitting anybody's wrists and he's not a serial killer. He's just a classic sociopath. The now, and that's what I would tell my sister. I would say, hey, you know, I've been reading descriptions and I've been listening to a psychologist that has a criminal justice psychologist. That's me, 15 years in the criminal justice business. And he, you know, I essentially have listened to this and listened to what he says about these things. And this guy would say that this guy, Brett, or whatever his name is, sorry if anybody's out there, his name is Brett, is a sociopath. And that these people can be very charming and, you know, attractive interpersonally, and people can really like them, but that's what they are. They're sociopaths. And so I would strongly recommend that you do exactly one thing, which is make absolutely certain that you don't get pregnant. Like, don't do anything else. I don't care what else you do. Okay. The secondary thing would be to not get married. Like, why be in such a hurry? Okay. So if it turns out I'm wrong and you're right, he's great, no problem. Then 2 years from now, you can have a great wedding and you can have a kid and can have a nice, happy family. But if it turns out in the next 2 years more evidence comes to light that I'm right, then you will be really, really glad that we took that conservative route. Why play a gambling game? Why not play a very conservative game? Because this is your life we're talking about. So, you know, have fun, enjoy your experience with this guy, but for God's sakes, put off any wedding and do not get pregnant, because I believe that this guy is a sociopath. That's what I would say. Okay. The classic in sociopathy is called The Mask of Sanity by Cleckley. That, you know, you could get it for the I think Robert Hare is a major researcher in sociopathy. I think he's written considerably and has probably had more modern books. Cleckley's is the classic. These people are just, you know, low empathy. They're fundamentally disagreeable. They're superficially can be agreeable. They can be. They're very tricky when they're naturally kind of confident, affable, physically attractive. Extroverted, and they obviously are very low in conscientiousness. So that's what that is, and that's what she's got. And she is, the sister is obviously dancing very near a dangerous fire. And if she, once again, I would say this. Let me frame this in the same way that I frame all the great tragedies of the world that everybody's panicked about. It's not that if you do things wrong, it's a disaster. That's not typically what's going to happen. It's just that we squandered a bunch of happiness. So a person's life could be set up well because they might be attractive, intelligent, you know, have reasonable skill and ability to access a marketplace, have a decent family, and it's like, you know, they're looking at a life that's going to be 8 out of 10. You know, it may not be 10 out of 10 because everything may not go your way, but the truth is it's going to be good. This is going to be a good life. And then if you make a bad decision like that, you can turn an 8 life into a 3 just on one decision. I had a good friend, you know, 20 years ago, really, really funny gal who's just had a great sense of humor. And she had married this guy and had a kid with him. And he was bad news. And it was trouble, trouble, trouble all the way down. Lawyers faxing her lawyers about who could talk to who and do what and go when and when he's going to show up and not show up. And then he shows up drunk and, you know, then he wants to put her on a kid on a motorcycle. It's like, oh, my God. And she came up with a phrase describing this that was beautiful. Don't breed with freaks. Okay? Don't breed with freaks. If you are in a relationship with somebody that is questionable in some significant area, go ahead and, you know, satisfy your overly open curiosity about your romance and the titillation of it all, et cetera. But don't breed with them. Don't do that, okay? Because what you get then is you are tied to that person forever. And they are an invasive force in your life, possibly forever. It's like, wow, you just took an 8 life and you just dragged it down a massive amount in that situation. So, is it a tragedy? No. But it's just it's a horrendously bad decision for happiness. So, yes, I forget what the parents wanted or didn't want the girl to do. Forget about it. Your job is to confront this as intelligently as you can figure out how to do it. And I would flood that sister with status before I did this. I would tell her, listen, I'm going to speak for 5 minutes, and then I'm going to leave this alone. Okay? You're going to give me 5 minutes. That's all I ask. You are just a superb person. I feel like you're so attractive. You're smart. You are a wonderful human being. You are so agreeable and pleasant, and you're such a team player, blah, blah, blah. I can remember the time you did this. I can remember the time it did that. I can't think of a better sister, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We are going to flood this girl for a minute and a half, okay? And we're going to use the technique that I say on my website. It's, you know, flood the circuit. It's called attribute anecdote. So you say the attribute, like you're so agreeable. I remember the time when, you know, there's this possible conflict of interest and you just said, no, I'll do without. So we bounce back and forth between the attribute that we're flattering them on and the attribute that is, in fact, the evidence for the reason why we have encapsulated or judged them to have that attribute. That's what we do, okay? And so we flood them with this scripted flood of positive feedback for a minute and a half. And then we say, this is why I think it would be, I cannot responsibly keep my mouth shut. Okay? You are way too good a person to be with this person. And this is what I think of him. Okay? and this is why I think of him. This happened, this happened, this happened, and this happened. And you know what I did? I'm so worried about you that what I did was I got some sort of expert analysis of this, and this is what's called a sociopath. Okay? He's not a killer. He's not going to slit your throat. I'm not worried about that. But he is shifty, and he's dishonest, and he's going to leave you in a lot of trouble. Okay? And you deserve so much better because you deserve your equal. You don't deserve somebody who's less than you. So here's some literature. You can look at it yourself. And all I'm going to tell you is the recommendation from the experts is when you can't make up your mind, for goodness sakes, don't get pregnant. Don't get married. Okay? Don't do it. If it's such a great idea and it's such a wonderful idea to get married and get pregnant, you can do that 2 years from now after you have considered carefully whether or not I'm right or you're right. Okay? So I don't want to set up an adversarial thing. I love you to death. Okay? But this is what I sincerely believe, and I swear you deserve better. And now I'll keep my peace. Okay? And here's an expert that you can talk to, and I'd give him my phone number. Okay, this is an expert that you can talk to, that was a professor at Stanford, and has 15 years of criminal justice experience, and this guy knows. Okay, and if you ever want to talk to him, you just say the word, or you call him directly. That's what I would do. Okay, you give that girl the best chance she's got at getting out of that trap. And right this minute, that's my first approximation about that. That's a decent first pass. As I go away in the next 48 hours, I'll think about 7 other things that I would say that might be trickier and more valuable. But that's the basic concept. We flatter the daylights out of her. We tell her we cannot stand by on the sideline. And now we just want this short length of time to make our case. Here's where she can get additional help. This is where the evidence is. And by God, you know, I'm doing everything I can to respect your privacy, but at the same time, do everything I can to help you. And you've got nothing to lose by taking your time. Don't make a big decision when a small decision will do. Okay? That's how I'd handle it. And good luck. Sounds like that guy might be good in bed, and we may have a problem.
All right. Well, we've got a listener on hold.
Okay.
So, listener, caller with the 530 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Oh, I guess the call just dropped. Okay.
Okay.
We're going to go on to our second caller with a 781 area code. Caller, what's your name?
Okay.
Where are you calling from?
Hey, Nathan, Dr. Lau, it's Rob again.
Hey,
okay,
Rob.
What's up?
Hey, I know we're short on time here, but I think I got another good one for you, Dr. Lau.
Okay.
Dr. Lau, there's a YouTuber I watch who says, all jobs suck, get used to it. And he has that's part of his shtick is he gives advice to people and says, all jobs suck, get used to it. And he talks about how people get, especially young people, get worthless degrees and they get out of college and they can't find a job. But without going into too many details about him, mm-hmm. it seems to me finding something you don't mind doing is the key here. And I don't know if you touch on this in your upcoming book, but it seems to me associated with this esteem dynamics and happiness, what are your basic thoughts on people, you know, in a country where they can find something that they don't mind doing, and like the connection there between your daily, you know, feeling productive, having a decent source of income, but realizing that there's negative sides to your job that might suck, but you find a way to like it and all that kind of stuff.
Rob, thank you. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, all the things that I learned from people. I'm getting a kick out of this guy's attitude. Now, what would I say about this? I would say that the following is going to be true. let me think about this for just a second. I have a comment here. I got to make sure that I can make it. Let me think. Ah, I can sort of make the comment. I know of a following situation of a guy that coming out of a professional school, he was in a position to negotiate with a local major professional firm, very large salary, cost him a lot of money to sort of buy into this firm. And he's an expert at what he does, and so he was expecting the job to be one set of procedures, and it's turning out now, late in the first year, that it's quite different than he thought he was going to get, what he was going to get. So he hates his work. And so the conversation that I had, not with him specifically, but with a third party, was, you know, what do we do about such a situation where a guy hates his work? He's got a big investment and, you know, got a wife, kids, et cetera, et cetera. The answer is, get the hell out. There are people that are in a position of power where you can maneuver your life in a position where your job does not suck. Your job can be excellent. Okay? There are many people that have to run a cost-benefit analysis on how it is that they go about this process. And this is maybe who this guy is speaking to. There are other people who have very few choices and essentially have to put up with, you know, very difficult circumstances in order to get financial security. So the truth of the matter is one brush does not paint this situation. So when I listen to people's lives and I hear about what's going on, you know, I want to know what their capabilities are, what their entire sort of financial background and picture is, and, you know, who they are and what they want out of life. And whenever I hear a six-figure and up person bitching about their job, my attitude is, why the hell are you doing it? You know, why aren't we maneuvering this thing into a situation that you enjoy, and if you make significantly less money by doing those maneuverings, then you have a better life, okay? So this is all about positions of power. Now, you were making a comment about something. I would also say something else, that a lot of jobs are unpleasant because of the people that are involved in those jobs. And so I have known people that were doing job X for 14 years in circumstances that were miserable. And then circumstances change for one reason or another, and they're doing the same job in circumstance Y, and now their life is a whole heck of a lot better. Why? Same job, different humans. So let's keep in mind that a very important issue in predicting the quality of a person's life is going to be what I call the esteem dynamics that are flowing through that person's life. And so that doesn't mean that if you have a disagreeable boss that that you should quit your job, because it's a package deal. But I would say that and there is something to be said from what this guy is sort of saying. He's making a comment here that not everybody is in a position that the optimal decision in this life is for them to feel like they, quote, do their passion. Now, you might say, well, now, wait a second about that. Is that really true? And I would say, yeah, be careful, because a lot of what people's passions are actually sexual displays. So many people feel they can feel the inherent value and double dipping, not only attempting to get survival resources as effectively and as efficiently as possible, but to also at the same time that they are getting resources for both survival problems and reproductive problems, but also be displaying their sexually attractive characteristics at the same time. Singing, dancing, acting, modeling, athletics, these are, you know, architecture. These are things where, you know, novel writing. People have a feel like, hey, that's my passion. That's what I ought to be doing for a living. At which point I would say, BS. Good luck to you. Okay? If you can do it for a living, spend your 20s trying to figure it out. I got a group and to listen to this podcast, I've found them out. They're a group of musicians, and they are a bunch of cool cats, and they're smart, and they're doing a good job, and they're doing well. And it's like, I think it's great. I think it's great that they are able to do that and do well. But not everybody can. And there comes a time when we have to run a reasonable cost-benefit analysis. And oftentimes, it's a smart cost-benefit analysis. Remember that in principle, the way the marketplace would work would be the following. The jobs that would generally be the least attractive jobs would pay the most in principle, okay, just by virtue of supply and demand. So I can expect that somebody who's trying to get a job as a lounge lizard singer is probably not going to get a lot of money for it, okay? Somebody that's going to try to do dancing for a living, unless you've got a body and it's a strip joint, don't expect to make much money from it. So now what we have to do is we have to look at, you know, the fact that there are jobs that are difficult and stressful, but they may pay well. And so good enough. So we're running an appropriate cost benefit that, quote, not everything about this job is great. There's parts of it that suck. But it achieves for me a lot of freedom and security to allow me to live a good life, you know, on the outside of this. So, yeah. Long, convoluted feedback on that, Rob. And I'm not sure I hit the nail on the head all the way through this, but hopefully somebody benefits from this meandering, and thank you for asking your question.
Rob, thank you very much for the call, and thank you very much for the question.
Dr.
Lyle, I think that's it for this evening. We'll go over the next situations next week.
Very good. All cool.
Excellent. Well, have a good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.